This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 41 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
What are we talking about this episode, Sum?
I believe this episode we are going to be discussing episode... Episode 206.
Yeah, and this was the doozy. I mean, there's other doozy-ish ones, if that's a word, but this one was the big doozy for me. So 205 ends with Diana killing that male witch who had come to suss her out or kill her, take her memories, whatever. And so we're brought up to speed or reminded what happened last episode. And so this episode formally begins with Diana is getting her rowing on 1590 style.
Can we talk about that? First of all, it was ridiculous. Oh, well, but not like I didn't think, oh, show, that was dumb. But because if her outlet is rowing, the only option she has is like a 16th century rowboat.
Is that big canoe?
And she doesn't have appropriate rowing gear there. So she has to row in what she's wearing. So, I mean, it all makes sense. But you have to, I think honestly, you know, when she screams when she's rowing, I don't think that had anything to do with her memories. I think that had 100% to do with the fact that that rowboat was not rowing the way she wanted it to row and that she couldn't move the way she wanted to move in that dress.
I don't think they meant for it to be funny.
And I'm just thinking, because if you get any of that wet, but if you get any, they were trying to be authentic. Like, if she wanted to row, she doesn't have the things, so she has to make do. I get that. I get it, and it makes sense. However, if she even gets that dress even a little bit damp, that dress is going to be so heavy. Getting out of that boat is going to be a nightmare.
Well, God forbid she like accidentally falls out. She's going to drown.
Tips over. Yeah. Yeah. It's not like it's steadied like those what do they call them? Those skulls? They call them skulls? I know.
No, I mean her dresses. She will drown because of everything will pull her down.
And I'm saying the rowboats are not aerodynamically as sturdy and steady as what do they call them? Skulls?
Oh, and they're not as light. Yeah.
It was very impractical, but I loved it. It was very, it was impractical, but it was ingenious at the same time.
Oh, I thought it was, I loved it. It was perfect. It was very, it made sense for her. And I don't think that there's any allusion to that in the book, which made it delightfully ridiculous and fitting.
Well, you know, in the book, and actually she did it in the show too. She did more than just rowing. She also did running and a bunch of other kind of physical activities, right? So, I mean, not to say that it would have been more practical for her to run in that dress, but, you know, if that's the...
No.
I don't know. That would have been even weirder.
Well, first of all, at least with running, you don't have the shoes. You don't want to hurt yourself. So at least with rowing, she has a chance of doing something that's at least closer than running in whatever heels she's got on. So she gets her row on, and we're reminded, or at least I was reminded, that she is getting rid of, it's one of her ways to get rid of adrenaline, right? Is to be physically active. Philippe says that he didn't summon the witch, but he also says he didn't interfere. He needed to be sure of her. So while he didn't call the witch dude there,
right,
he also saw that this was an opportunity
to see what she's going to do. What's she going to do?
Well, see what she's made of. Exactly. Diana saved herself. So this is a conversation between Philippe and Matthew. In that conversation, Philippe says, lives will be lost because of your union. So they kind of go back and forth a little bit and they dispose of the body. And Diana is so Matthew goes to meet Diana, right? She gets out and she ties up the boat. It's like she's doing so much work. And they're talking there. Stephanie, you're going to have fun with this one. And Diana is all, I will not be tested like that. That is not okay. And then as they are back with Philippe, he sees the ring. So that reminded me when we had a discussion in 205.
So, but did you see in the scene? We did. But did you see in this scene? She walked over away from them because when Philippe and Matthew were yelling at each other, she walked away from them back to the window where that bag was and grabbed it and put it on her ring finger because it was on her. She put it on her pointer finger last week and then put it back away. But today, say, she walked purposefully over there while they were screaming at each other and took the ring back out and put it on her ring finger.
Well, see, I didn't think she put the ring back on. I thought she just had the ring on.
No, because she never put it on that finger.
So she put it on. And Philippe sees it and he kind of goes a little bit nutso and he's like, what do you have there? What's going on? It's Isabeau's ring. Obviously, he recognizes it. It was his gift to her. And he's like, you would not have that unless I didn't live. Or I were no longer living. And my brain's all, here we go. And then Matthew's all, no one is truly immortal, Father, not even you.
Oh.
So that kind of started, well, actually, no, it started in 205, right? 205 was...
Just think how humbling that must be. Just because, God, well, he's been so powerful. He's just been so powerful for so long, you know, and always so careful and so lucky and so everything. And almost a charmed life, if you will. As a vampire, that he's been able to live as long as he has, and imagining having lived as long as he has, just seeing it go on forever, right? He can't imagine not being anymore. And to have this proof in your face that what you have now will not be forever.
That some point in the future, he's gone. And the hard thing, although I don't know what makes it harder, because obviously Matthew's not going to give him any details of his passing. I think the hard thing is he realizes he's not living. At whatever time she got the ring, he's not around. What he doesn't know is if he dies in 50 years, in 100 years, or in 500 years. That almost is harder, like knowing that you could go any time. When truly, yes, no one is truly immortal. So that I thought was a little bit, oh, that was sad. So back to Diana. So all of this happened. It's like the show opens with her rowing and then we get all these scenes. And then now we're back. So I was wrong. Now she's ending her rowing. So Diana is rowing off her stress and her anger, her fear, whatever was going on. And yeah, it's definitely a lot louder in the 16th century rowboat. It's not as graceful as the...
So one other thing I wanted to say about that moment is that him realizing that the schism he had identified that was between him and Matthew in the future, it was the reality that schism, and I'm probably saying that word wrong, is his death. So something happened and he's not there anymore. And that could possibly be the reason that Matthew was so angry at him.
Yes. And that's what I was getting at when I started to say that this actually started in 205. Meaning, although the fight happens here in 205, like Matthew opens that up when he on their journey, when he tells Diana, I don't know the exact line, but it was along the lines of, you're ripping open an old wound. And it's what she thinks, and she's not wrong, is that, or the only thing she can think, because she doesn't know anymore, he hasn't shared yet, but what she thinks, and of course what the audience thinks, is, well, in Diana's time, there is no Philippe. She knows that he's gone, and that she may or may not know, like, what exactly happened with the Nazis or whatever, but she knows that he's gone, and he's been gone since the Nazi time. But she doesn't know the circumstances of his passing and all of that. So when they're, you know, riding on the horses all the way on the way to set tour, and he says it's going to be like ripping open an old wound, I think that's understandable, because it's like you lost someone and you're never maybe quite, I hate the phrase over it. I don't think, maybe some people get over it. I personally don't get over a big loss. I get through it, and with time it gets less.
Oh, but sometimes you choose to stay under it.
No. Yeah. So what I'm trying to
say, my melancholy friend.
So what I'm trying to say is that I think the audience understands, or would understand him saying it's like, you know, ripping open an old wound. I think what we are led to think, and Diana as well, is that the reason he's going to be sad or open up that wound is because he's going to see someone who in his time is dead. So obviously that makes the most sense. I think we all can appreciate how awesome it is to see someone you miss, but also like, oh crap, like your body doesn't know how to, or your mind, or, you know, your logic knows this is happening because of time travel, but your emotional body, your psyche, the part that just is like along for the ride, is, you know, it, that must be intense, like very, like, how do you process that and then go away again? So I think we're all set up for that, right? So we all expect an opening of this wound. What we are not told, of course, and Diana is not told until episode 206, is more of the circumstances of what happened, which will come a little bit later. But yeah, so Matthew actually sets us up for pain and loss and ripping open a wound. So Matthew sets us up for pain in this episode. We just don't necessarily know all that entails, but we do find out a little bit more. So Matthew comes to get her, or help her wrap up the rowing, and he says, "Don't shut me out." And she says she needed time to think. And she says something that surprises her. She's like, "I don't know what's going on. I wanted to kill that guy." Well, Diana, you did. You actually did kill him too. She's more upset, and which I get. She's more upset at the fact that she was feeling like she wanted to over the fact that she did. But she did it absolutely in self-defense, which is, understandable. I think all of us would see that and say, yes, he's trying to, in the end, destroy you. Because what would you be without those memories, right? So he is trying to destroy you. So yes, you have every right to defend yourself. But there's a difference between, oh my gosh, I don't want to die. It's him or me. I'm not judging that difference. I'm just saying I can see why she would say, or why she would feel a little bit, scared or worried or what, apprehensive, because it's not just the need she's expressing or expressing what she was feeling, not just the need to defend herself. She wanted to destroy him. She wanted to kill him. And she asks him, "What am I becoming?" And then we have the Pyrex opening.
Every time you say that, I'm imagining someone's walked in with, it's a potluck, and somebody's opening like their covered Pyrex, and they're like, "And now the Pyrex is opening, and it's episode 206.
So Philippe now knows he's going to die at some point. He begins at this point, he does not finish it, but he begins, or at least attempts to begin, to write a letter to his wife. And then we flash to Isabeau in present time, feeling her ring from him. She's got a ring from him. And it's the same ring that he has on, I believe. Actually, it's his ring, but she's wearing it in her time. And I thought, I know the lines were not exactly this, but this is what came to my mind when you can tell for people in present time, they're all like, something has shifted, right? What I thought was, something has changed within me. Something is not the same. So she feels something has changed. And we have witches too. This is the best mashup ever. The witches feel it too. They feel vibration. Such a sweet sensation. Okay, that was really not good. So the books were Philippe. We learned from Isabeau, as she's telling the witches, books were Philippe's favorite hiding places. He would hide little notes to her. And once...
But I loved the way that they said... I love the way that Mart said that, though. There's something wrong with the witches. I'm imagining, what does she mean there's something wrong with them? I mean, they're witches. There's innately something wrong with them to them, right? So I'm like, what exactly are they doing? And then she takes him in there and she's like, "What are you doing? You're not allowed in here. This is private." And they're like, "We know, but..." And apparently the "but" was just enough. And I love that the way that they edited this episode together, because nothing is current and present until it's been done in the past. And because he hasn't done it yet, it's not there. I love the idea that they don't just magically already know all the things. It's not like it's just permanently in their psyche now, because they're like, "Oh, we know now. It happened." And how did she not? And when you think about with time travel paradoxes and issues like that, is that technically it should already be there, because it's been 500 years and everything that they've done in the past has already happened. But the fact that the intent to do it hasn't happened yet in their timeline, I love how that made its way into this. And it could be there the whole time, right? It could have been there the whole time, but she didn't find it until she was by herself.
Philippe, God bless him, even through everything he went through at the end, he kept his word. I know they weren't torturing him for this specific information, but he, for 500 years, didn't say a ding dong, or a little bit less than 500 years, didn't say a ding dong thing. I guess it was 400, 15, 67, 18, 19. It's a little bit less than 400 years, sorry. He didn't say a ding dong thing about their visit. He kept his word. Because if he had told them, then she would have known. And she did not know. And that was to protect everyone. So not just he kept his word. Remember he said he had everyone there sworn to silence and blah, blah, blah. So that was a lot of work, but they got it done.
But just imagine how well he was respected that everyone did it.
Oh, yeah. Respected and
how much character that builds.
Respected and feared.
I mean, that most respect is earned with a modicum of fear. Let's be honest.
I don't know that I would call that respect.
Fear is not always fear of violence. Sometimes it's fear of disappointment.
Yeah, but then you're not afraid of a person. You are afraid of disappointing them, which is different. And I don't know. I mean, if it's still fear, then I don't know that I would call that fear-based respect. You may not want to let down someone whom you respect, which I get.
It's an element of respect. I don't think it's based. I don't think it's fear-based, but I think that fear is an element of all respect. And the fear is in you, and it's not caused generally by the other person. It could be something that's caused by you in how you want to be seen by this other person. That's how I see it. You and I can have different opinions about it, and that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I just don't, because I think for a long time, even myself, I think for a long time I would have gone along with something like that, like a definition of something like that. But the problem...
But you no longer are afraid of disappointing me?
I'm saying in general. And I think in society, I think relationships, professional relationships in society, I think you don't, you can, and I know we're not talking about ruling, but you can rule or lead with fear, but they don't respect you. They fear you. And I think if you fear someone, I don't know how you have true respect in there, because respect to me is, and I don't mean to me like my wishy-washy definition of it. I mean, to have respect for someone. If I'm afraid of them, my whatever that feeling is based on fear. It's not based on respect. So I'm not saying they can't intermingle. I just have a hard time seeing them intermingle, because something that is garnered or ruled by fear, it's not respect. I don't see that as respect. But it doesn't mean like, but this is a perfect example of where maybe that actually can be true, right? Because Philippe is absolutely respected, but they also know that, okay, I can allow for fear in this way. So I would agree that people who are there at... Well, first of all, I'd say straight up, there are people that fear Philippe, obviously. And he doesn't have to do much about it because his reputation is out there, right? So that exists. No one's doubting that people fear him. But I would say that, yes, people that work for him or on the estate, they may fear him. But people who know him absolutely respect him and probably have a healthy... I don't want to say fear, but a healthy whatever that is to know, you know, like not to get on his bad side kind of thing. I think you can, in Philippe's case and the people working at Asset Tour, for example, I think you can respect them and know that if you get out of line, that there are consequences, right? That doesn't mean that a person necessarily rules by fear, but there are consequences everywhere. So if you don't want to go to jail, if you don't want to, you know, go on the rack, or if you don't want to do this, have this, this, and this done to you, but you know those are consequences for doing X, then you will do your best not to do X. You can have a fear of consequences, maybe, and maybe that absolutely ties into fear of a person. But anyway, that's a little bit off. But the witches feel a vibration.
You know what, though? I bet it was a combination. You said he kept that secret for 500 years, or almost 500 years.
Well, just under 400, actually.
But he kept it from everybody, even Matthew. I imagine that every interchange he had with Matthew from like then on was perhaps a little bit like, I know something you don't know.
Well, you got to think about it. So just like Isabeau didn't know about that last letter until it was written, she'd already been through the past with him, right? It didn't happen until Matthew went back. So I don't think, so Philippe didn't know everything until Matthew went back.
Right.
So there was in their first time round, if you will, there was nothing in the 300 plus years they had together. There was nothing for Philippe to tell her.
I didn't say her. I was saying Matthew.
Well, there was nothing for him to tell Matthew either.
No, but there was from 300 years on. There was absolutely something he could have told him, like, I'm sorry you're having a bad time dating that girl. Just wait. You're going to meet somebody great and then you're going to come back.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because it was always in Philippe's timeline, you're saying. Okay.
From then on, from once they've gone back.
Yes. Okay. This is getting a little bit too much into TT, and that can, I love it, but it can also make my head hurt. Like everyone.
I just want to make your head hurt. That is literally my goal.
So books were Philippe's favorite hiding places. Something is kind of shifting in the force, who knows? And so thus begins an episode of looking for something that he has hidden. And I, this is because, yes, I literally talk like this, not all the time, but this is what I said. Poop squirt. This is where I started crying and really never stopped.
Okay, so here's my question. They went through and flipped through all those books, except there was that one book that remained bound the entire time. What if that had been the book that had the thing in it? Like it was tied shut with like a strap. There's a book that is tied shut with like a thong, like a leather thong. I'm just saying, she picks it up again at the end and never does anything with it, and then finds it magically in another book that she's already looked in the binding. But they never actually opened the book that was tied shut.
It's not just looking, all the witches can do. I mean, I don't know. The witches feel something has changed, right? Or something is different. But I don't know that the witches can feel. They absolutely can. Like, they're capable of it, but they don't have a connection to Philippe. Or maybe I'm actually backwards. Maybe the witches go by feel and Isabeau has to go by page because she doesn't have the magical kind of feeling. But she does feel that something has changed. So maybe she does have that. But in the end, she doesn't go by feeling. She has it in front of her and she picks it up and she sees it poking out of the top. So it's not a feel thing. It's a see thing. It's a sight thing.
All I'm saying is that they were flipping every book open and filing through all the pages, and there is one book that is tied shut with a leather thong that they never open. No, she picks it up and then sets it back down. Like, she never opens it to see if anything is in the pages. I thought it was strange when they like rifled through all of these really old books looking for something in between the pages, and that one was tied shut the whole time.
Back in 1590, Philippe tries to write. So this is kind of along the lines with what the change in the force, right? The disruption in the force that the witches are feeling. So she is trying to write. He begins to try to write, and he looks outside the window or hears a noise, and Matthew is working with the horses, and Philippe is all, nah. And so he stops. He does not get any further with the writing at this time. And he's all, not going to happen. You're going to tell me what the hell is up. What happens to me? What's going on? But first,
even better,
we're going to fight.
Let's go to the courtyard. I'm going to throw a sword at you, and then I'm going to scream about time travel. I'm going to scream for everyone to hear about time travel.
And
like, it's not a big deal. But I mean, they are screaming in English, so maybe they didn't understand.
So yeah, they have this great fight scene, and Matthew is saying that Baldwin will ensure Isabeau's safety in the future. And Philippe asks, I know.
Poor Baldwin. He says that like he's some redheaded stepchild.
Philippe asks, how long has she been without me? Matthew won't answer. He asks again, how long have I been dead in your time? And Matthew says, I cannot answer that. Over and over again, he is asking these questions. And Matthew says he can't disclose it because it can affect other lives. Matthew says he stepped out of Mathieu's shadow a long time ago, and he will not be a pawn anymore.
Two things. They then cut to Diana in his study, actively changing the past. Can we talk about that? She didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah, we're going to get there. So meanwhile, Diana goes into a room, and someone made a comment some point early on in this season and stayed with me, and it makes me laugh so much. There are so many doors that are see-through. I just love it. So
that doesn't count.
It's a door.
That can't count. No. Doors keep the... No.
It opens and closes. It's a door. It is a door.
It's a gate. It's a gate. There's a gate.
It's a separation that opens and closes between two spaces. It is a door. So she goes into a room with a see-through door. That just made me laugh. So she's... Gates don't go from floor to ceiling some.
They can.
They can be high. They don't... Gates... And gates aren't usually, well, unless they're baby gates or puppy gates, they're not indoors. Anyway, she's basically snooping in his office or some area. I don't know that it's Philippe's office. She comes across a map of covens, witches' covens, across Burgundy. And one of the servants is telling her about it. And Isabel relies on it to guide her witch hunts. So Diana fancy hands all the different locations all around. So she does not mind changing things.
Right. And that's what I guess for her, it doesn't feel like it's going to matter because she doesn't have to step back into this timeline. But he does. And I wouldn't. And if they are so set on not changing things so that they get back to what they left behind, I'm like, good God, everything you do echoes throughout eternity, right? It's like everything you do is going to have a butterfly effect. And if you change and don't kill all these witches that Isabeau killed in the future, what the fuck are you going to go back to? There could be some crazy shit. I mean, clearly it doesn't make that big of a difference to their particular timeline that we get to know about later, but that actively affected all of those different covens' timelines. And that was really haphazard of her.
Back to the fight. Now, let's go up some stairs. Philippe has a big old leap.
Now, let's destroy all the furniture and apples.
Philippe has a big old leap, and he is... So, Philippe not only wants to know information from Matthew, he's also trying to push him... Well, there's more behind it, which we learn a little bit later. But he's also pushing him into a rage. He wants that blood rage to come out. And we get it.
Well, because he's hoping if he loses control, he'll get the answer he wants.
Well, it's more than just that. But that's part of it. He wants the information, but there's a second layer to it. So, he pushes him, they fight, and we get... Matthew does. He comes into the blood rage, start to come out, and we hear him growl, and there's the rage, and there's lots of destruction. And then so Philippe has a growling Matthew on his back on a table. Diana comes in to see Matthew in full blood rage. He's called a pure predator, and Philippe is saying, tell me how I die. And Matthew says, I cannot tell you. And then Philippe says, then your conscience has the better of me. So I think Matthew actually says something. I listened to it a few times. I couldn't make it out. He does say, I cannot tell you. And I think he might use the word conscience, but I couldn't make out the rest of the line. It was very short. But Philippe's response saying, then your conscience has the better of me, leads me to believe that one of the words that he says was conscience. I just couldn't catch the end of the line because it was so low. And this is when Philippe kind of is like, he's like, okay, like I've done what I can to try to beat it out of you. So Matthew had trained himself to hold the blood rage back. And this is the first time in a very long time that he had not been able to hold it back. I mean, come on, there's holding it back, which he does every day. And then there's being beaten into it. Come on.
Well, I mean, but think about it.
Philippe knew exactly what he was doing.
Of course he did. But if you think about it, in his current day, right? If he starts going all blood ragey, people back off.
Yeah. That's true.
And they let him compose himself. And Philippe is not allowing him any space, any quarter, any anything. He wants him to reach that place and be like, stop. You know, you're holding back your... Because he sees his blood rage's potential. Because he has the blood rage, but he also can control it. So he has been using him as a weapon to destroy the other people with blood rage.
Or just... But not just that. His assassin, period. So he really... So Philippe is mostly concerned, of course, about Isabeau. Well, sorry. In this conversation, he... wants to get that information. And yes, he's worried about Isabeau, but he's trying to get this information. And now that they've stopped the fighting, but Matthew's in a blood rage and Diana's there, Philippe is using this as an opportunity to educate Diana more about Matthew. And he says, this is the blood rage. It's from Isabeau. She's a carrier, but both Matthew and Louisa have it. And it made me laugh. Like Diana almost goes Southern when she says, Do you really think I would ever walk away from you, my love, after all we've been through? But at the beginning of that line, it almost went Southern, but it didn't actually land.
Well, that's because it goes almost Australian.
Fair enough. That's true. The acting landed. There's nothing wrong with the acting. It's just the pronunciation. So again, he tries to tell her how bad he is. He says, I was Philippe's weapon. He used me to eradicate the disease. That reflects what Summer said. And he says, oh, and then she says, he made you his assassin. Diana says to Philippe, and this is that second layer. So the first layer that's easiest to see and we all pick up on is that he's trying to get Matthew to tell him about his death, right? Or the rest of his life, how much time he has, what are the conditions, what happens. The other layer is that he is getting Matthew built up, stoked into a blood rage so that Diana will see Matthew for who he truly is. He wants to make sure Diana is right for him. So he's doing a lot of things. Diana says to Philippe, you provoked and humiliated, exploited his pain to drive me away. And Philippe says, you need to see the wolf behind the man. You have to accept everything of him. He must accept.
How ironic that he says wolf.
I know, right? And he says, and this is where, like I said, I'm not crying during this right now, but on the watch, I pretty much started crying when I said whatever I said earlier. And like it's start and stop.
You were primed.
Huh?
You were primed.
Oh, well, I was primed because of the episode. Like I knew what was coming. Not when I first watched it, I didn't know every line. No, but I knew.
I'm just saying once you start, you're already on that precipice. You've already pushed yourself into that mood. So it just takes a little tip instead of.
And this next part, so he, on the surface, and it's the truth, it's not a lie, he's trying to get information from Matthew. Another layer is that he is pushing him into this rage so that Diana can see him, so that she knows everything that he is. And that he, if she is truly wanting to be with him, she has to accept everything of him. That's the second one. And then it's for Matthew, even though he's saying this to, I mean, I think he's near Matthew. Matthew, I think, hears all of it. Plus, he's a vampire. He hears everything. But he also says, he's like, he doesn't say this part, but this is me ad-libbing. He's like, look, I tried to get the truth out of him. He won't tell me anything, but something's going on and he has got a lot of guilt. He has to accept all of the guilt that he carries. And so that's something you're like, wait, what? So we, even as viewers, as readers, we know, but as viewers, we don't know about this guilt. Guilt that he's gone. I mean, usually guilt is you have guilt over something that you've done or not done, right? Either you didn't do something you should have done or you did something you shouldn't have done. Something like that, usually. Well, we haven't heard anything yet that's necessarily guilt-worthy, right? Sadness and missing someone and mourning.
Well, that's because
he hasn't said it yet.
Because he's hiding from his guilt. He is so ashamed of what he's done. He's afraid that telling other people will make them look at him differently and treat him differently. And he doesn't want that.
Correct. So Philippe says, you must be united, meaning you have to know everything about him and he has to know everything about you, all of that. And says, your faith in each other has to be unwavering. So that other second, and maybe you might be able to argue a third, but definitely a second layer would be, he did this. He did this provocation for them. to give them a chance to prove themselves committed to each other. So it forces, number one, he tried to get information out of Matthew. Obviously, that didn't work. Number two, he wanted to get him into a blood rage so that Diana could see everything she was getting into, but also, which then is connected, because it's something that she needs to see, right? She needs to be accepting of to know that what she's getting into, but also helps lead them into that conversation of, you have to know all about each other, and the blood rage is just part of it. And thus, whatever he's got this guilt from, he's got to open himself up to it. He's got to accept it or forgive himself or whatever is going on, but he needs to accept that. And he doesn't say these words, but what the next step is, and which Matthew does later, is you need to share that burden, because that will help lighten it. And it does for them later. Philippe is definitely he's a doer. He's a machinations dude. But Diana talks back. She's like, who are you to lecture me on my legacy? I am worthy of your son. And for a second, they're so close.
Wait, he says, no, he says that. He says, who are you to lecture me about my legacy? And then she says, I'm worthy of your son.
And they're so close for a second, and I actually wouldn't have been upset. For a second, it looks like Philippe and Diana are about to kiss. It just because of how close they get. And I was like, damn.
I didn't see that at all.
Sorry, I did. Because they were close. It was like...
Are you writing fanfic? Are you writing fanfic right now, Ginger?
No, Summer. No. It's like in Outlander, when one of the last scenes of Lord John, and he was on the balcony or the whatever you call it of the big house with Brianna, and he stands behind her and kind of look. He's so much taller than her. He kind of looks over her shoulder, and it looks like it's the perfect time for him to like start necking her. So like, really? So that's what it was. It wasn't because of the scene. Like, the scene did not call for it, but it was such an intimate scene emotionally, and they were so close. I was like, oh, okay. I'm not going to say no to that. Anyway, he sees on her, he sees this witch, her witch's glamour. He sees the light and the shining around her. And he says, an ancient prophecy tells of a witch who will change the destiny of all creatures. Or some believe that this fearsome witch will alter our understanding of life itself. The old world will die and the new will be born. And as he's saying this, first of all, I'm even getting a tear prick now. But as he is saying this, like, you get this just this beautiful, subtle, not subtle because you can definitely see it, but subtle as in it's not over the top, right? This beautiful, like, little light shooting lights and like a glow. And it's just, it's done so, whew, so beautifully. And she asks him, what do you believe? And he says,
I believe you are power indeed.
And she says, yes, I am. But let's get to the point. No, I was kidding. She says, yes, I am. But I love your son, and that should be enough. So that was another like tear pricker jerker of a scene. So Philippe says he won't ask of his future again. He knows that if he responded with violence in their time, then the congregation would freak out and there would be a war and he would lose her. Meaning Matthew. If in their time, Matthew responded to their threats against Diana about, you know, you shouldn't be together, a vampire and a witch. If he responded with violence, that there would be a war between at least some of the creatures or even just the vampires. No, it would be witches too, because we got Nox et al. And he would lose her, and possibly even not just lose her, but people would die. Philippe knows why they escaped to the past. So he says there must be no doubt that she is de Clermont. He says family is made through blood. And then he cuts himself and he puts a stain of blood or some blood on her forehead. And he says, with this mark, you are dead, a shade only, without clan or kin. And then a second mark. And with this mark are reborn and forever a member of our family. Diana is a de Clermont. And that music that comes up, ooh.
And I just sat there thinking, so no, when can she wash that off? Does she have to leave that there forever? Or like, or does it soak in? Or
does it soak in?
Or because I'd be like, what's proper protocol here?
Well, the music that comes up at that time, oh, the music is beautiful. And the way he walks away, he's like, I've done everything I can. I mean, there's more celebration and all stuff. There's more stuff to happen. But the way he walks away, it's just, it was sad. He's like, this is my purpose. I'm almost done with my purpose in life. Time to chat. Diana asks Matthew if he's okay. And this is the entry of us, Diana, getting more information about Philippe's death. And this is as much as we get. So Philippe was taken during World War II trying to free Allied spies. So he was working with the Allies and he was part of a resistance, right? He was helping, but he was caught. He was held in a Nazi death camp. He was the first vampire that they had captured and they were fascinated with him. Now they knew about witches. They had witches there. And so they used witches on him. They extracted his memory and they tortured him to see what he could endure. For 3 months, They tortured him daily. Baldwin ended up rescuing him, but his mind was broken. He begged Isabeau to kill him, but she wouldn't or couldn't. So in the end, Matthew had done it. And he says, whew.
He says, every time Isabeau looks at him now, that's all she thinks about.
He says, well, yeah, but I'm talking about his death first, girl. You know, I got to play this out. So Matthew did it. Philippe's memories, he says, were like shards of glass. He was broken and frightened, but his heart was fierce. And his final...
He said, well, before that, he said most creatures' memories unravel.
Yes.
But his were like shards of glass. So like you imagine memories unraveling kind of like a ribbon.
Yeah.
But his were so broken that they were like shards of glass. I don't imagine he wanted to experience that either. So he's had to carry the memory of that, the memory of those memories.
And he says his heart was fierce and his final moments, all he thought of was Isabeau. And Isabeau can't look at Matthew without thinking about that day. And now Matthew laments that he has to face Diana too. So Diana's trying to tell him, look, you didn't kill him. You released him. And Diana is not only lightening his burden by having it shared. She's telling him, assuring him, you didn't do a bad thing. You did a difficult thing. That's understandable, but you didn't do a bad thing. You did not cause his death. The Nazis killed him. You released him from the torture that he was going through for who knows how much longer it would have lasted.
Well, he's immortal. It would have gone on forever.
So that's why he needed to be released, because there was no end.
That's what I'm saying.
So we get to present day Setur. Again, something in the forest is funky. They're looking through the books. The feeling is still there, but it's been fading. Marthe brings Isabeau a drink and says, I will help you look. Back in 1590, Philippe and Diana are out riding, and he asks about Isabeau. She says, she's well, but lonely. And Philippe says, thank you for that. It's not fun to hear, but at least I know she's well. Then Matthew comes up. They all come upon a temple dedicated to Artemis, the Greek goddess of the hunt, which is, of course, the counterpart to the Roman Diana. We get a hint of just how old Philippe is. So they do a lot without saying a lot. Philippe is not like Philippe is beyond, as is Isabeau age-wise. So Philippe, we believe, is Greek, hence the Greek pantheon. And he's been around for a day or two.
But I bet he never got that answer from Diana before.
So he says, no, that's true.
That was special.
He says they'll be married in 2 days.
I love that. You're going to get married.
He needs a lock of her hair, and he gives her some money, and he wants him to put it on the altar to Artemis.
Do you think because now she's his daughter, he's like, you're going to make an honest woman of my daughter. No more of this half-mated shit. You're not going to walk around playing house with my daughter. You're going to marry her and make an honest woman of her.
I don't know what he was like at all, meaning I don't know what's in his brain. But I mean, that's a funny take of it. That's funny. So he asks for, he dedicates her basically, and asks for Artemis's protection. So Philippe has got some power going on too. Philippe is not a witch, and I know it was the power of the goddess there, but Philippe can call the goddess. So you gotta think there's something extra special about Philippe. Yes, he's a vampire, but before he was a vampire, he was already extra special. There's a little bit of inference there, nothing stated outwardly by the author, but definitely he's got an in with the Greek pantheon, let's put it that way. That's a hint to how old this dude might be, right? And Philippe, or Philippus, is a Greek word. It's a Greek name. So then we see the manifestation of the goddess, a white deer. And
that was a stag. Wasn't it a stag?
I gotta say, I want to say it was a deer. A stag. But because it was representing the goddess, I would think it would be female. But maybe it can be any white deer, male or female. I don't know. So yes, and it winked, and it was funny, but also very touching. And then Philippe walks off and Matthew asks her to marry him there at the temple.
No, he says, so I guess we're getting married. And she goes, if you ask nicely. That was hysterical.
And then it's wedding time. So he looks, oh Lord have mercy. He looks good at anything, but he looks so good in that shirt and boots. Just the white shirt. Yes, the pants too. Philippe has a gift for Matthew. Something he found on a battlefield during the Vampire Wars. It's something blue. A fibulum. He wants him to wear it during the ceremony.
Honestly, it looked like an old kilt brooch. Like a Roman kilting brooch.
Yes, it looked like it would hold it together.
It's a fibula. A fibula is a brooch or pin for the fastening garments, typically on the right shoulder. They're toga pins.
So that's that word. Then we have like a wider shot of that bell ringer on top of the building. It almost looked fake, like it was until they did a wider shot and you could see it was actually a person, and he like hopped down, I think. And then we get the money shot, right? Her coming out of those doors. The music that accompanies her coming out of the door in her wedding dress. Oh, so beautiful. I talked a little bit. Well, we talked a lot about the song, the music for the wedding with Rob Lane, which you will hear soon, our interview with him. And one of the things, I don't know, my guess is Summer did not hear it. And I'm guessing most people didn't hear it. But as I was listening to the music that accompanies her, so not Time in a Bottle, not the music that is the opening for Time in a Bottle. That's completely the second. All of the music during the actual wedding is not Time in a Bottle, right? That's next. But the music for the wedding starts just about the time when she comes out of the door, beautiful with that big ruff. And all the way through, they get married by the priest, all of that. You see, or you hear, excuse me, you hear, or maybe you don't hear. They're in the beginning and in the end of it. It's not a very long piece. You hear some fifths. The music goes, da, da, da. Da, and then it goes on, da, 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 da. And then toward the end of the piece, it does it again. Da, 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 da. And to me, what I connected that with is marriage is, you know, it's a unification of these two people, right? And that music, it was major. It wasn't sad or minor or anything. But when you have repeated fifths like that, there's a point to it. If it's something pretty, you just want part of your music, you do it once and then maybe again at the end. But this was twice. It was done twice. And then another, I think there was even an octave in there. So all this to say, I got the feeling several times or whenever I hear these fifths, it goes up and comes back down. It goes up and comes back down. It's return. Turning to me, what it was emphasizing was coming home, resting on that tonic. That is why that affected me so much. But it was, and I wrote, oh, those fifths coming home. It is beautiful. It's not sad because it's minor. It's just sometimes really beautiful things. There's a hint in the music that is a little bit sad because, and same with Time in a Bottle, that even though it's a beautiful ceremony, it's beautiful music, right? These people are beautiful, all that, and they're celebrating. And this is a very joyous occasion. It's also the last time, well, this experience, right? It's just before they leave. So this is the last time that Matthew will see Philippe. And the only time that we know of at this moment that Diana will ever see Philippe. And so seeing it as like a double-edged sword, right? Or where everything is beautiful as far as their happiness, they're finally together, all of that. But also, and the fact that they get to celebrate it with Philippe, but also that they're about to leave and Philippe's going to start the rest of his life off, right? Knowing what happens, not knowing, they know what happens to him. So listen to our interview with Rob Lane for more information about what happened with Time in a Bottle, because it wasn't... It wasn't supposed to be there, or at least it wasn't the plan. It's very interesting how that came about. So definitely listen to that. But I loved that music.
I'd like to talk for a moment about the ceremony and not the music. Because one, that was the shortest Catholic ceremony I have ever seen in my entire life. And I've been to a Catholic wedding and they are long. There's a lot of sitting, kneeling, standing, and prayers and prayers and prayers and homilies and all the other things. And then you get married. This was literally two sentences and a smiley priest. And on top of that, that priest very clearly said moi, and they very clearly spoke English back. So I'm like, you couldn't even for one sentence speak French to this priest who's here to officiate you?
That was funny. It was I was glad for the purposes of listeners that it was in English, I guess, but I was like, yeah, it would have been so pretty to hear this in 1590s French.
And actually, you know, the length of a Catholic ceremony.
I mean, everyone knows what's going to happen. It's not like if you don't have subtitles, we're not going to know. We know that they're getting married. The actual words don't matter. They matter. But my point is, people aren't going to be left out in the dark about the storyline if they don't get subtitles for this.
Well, here's the thing. They didn't even have to actually show them saying anything to each other. They could have just shown them mouthing words at the priest with the music over it. Like, and then given the illusion that it was perhaps a longer ceremony, and because it's Catholic, but it could have been a longer ceremony. We just don't need to watch all of it. But this gave the indication because she walked straight out. They said, I give myself to you and I receive you. I give myself to you and I receive you. Now kiss. That was the ceremony.
Think about this, because you probably didn't notice this. You noticed it was different, right? It was shorter. But if I'm not mistaken, from what I know about Catholic weddings, or not ceremonies, but weddings specifically, I'm not saying it's impossible. I think you have to get some kind of, not allowance, there's a word, dispensation maybe. But typically, if you are Catholic or you're being married in the church and by a priest, right? Like you can't from what I understand, you can't just say, oh, Catholic priest in my diocese or in my parish, we want to have a backyard wedding. Like, no, that's not how it works. You can have a reception. You can have, I don't even know, a dedication. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not a canon lawyer. I'm not a priest, obviously. But from what I understand, you cannot just decide that you want to have an outdoor wedding and just, you know, pay the priest and he'll come, because it's part of that sacrament is being done in the church and all that. Anyway, I did not think about it till just now that they were not actually in the church. They were in front of the church. And I'm wondering if that's because he was kind of in front of the door. But yeah, I am wondering if they did that because they wanted everything outdoors, like for shooting purposes, or if it was done. And I'll have to go back to the book and see what happened in the book, because I don't remember. But I'm curious if that was done on purpose, meaning done on purpose for the shot, or done on purpose as something like, you know, yeah, we're going to be married. It's going to be a Catholic priest because Matthew is Catholic and she's totally down with that. She understands it's important to him, right? And the family. So she's not against it, but she also, and she can go into a church, like obviously it's not going to burn down or anything, or she's not going to die. But as a witch, maybe it was some kind of nod to, we respect you and your tradition, whatever, I don't know. And this is kind of like a middle ground. We'll do it with a priest in front of the church. You know what I mean? I don't know. I never thought about that until just now. I always thought it was beautiful. And there was nothing to think about. Yeah, well, you're welcome. You didn't think about it having meaning either, as far as not being indoors. Yeah, we'll have to think about it. So let us know what you guys think.
Hey, I don't have to think about it myself to jog something in you. You know what I mean? So it's not that I thought of the same thing. It's that what I said made you think and brought you to a new realization. So you're welcome.
So it's time for the father of the bride dance. And since he's her father now, double father.
I'm going to just say this because I was unable to participate in our Rob Lane interview, but you should all go listen to it. But my feelings about my first viewing of this episode was that, that music kind of sounds like Time in a Bottle, but it's not. It sounds like it, but it's not. And I was thinking to myself, how many notes can you use that are exactly the same before it becomes plagiarism? And then Honeymoon starts, and then it became 100% Time in a Bottle. Because I was like,
oh, Lord have mercy. You're like, where's this going? This can't be going there.
I was like, I swear to God, that sounds like Time in a Bottle, but it's not ever resolving into it. And then all of a sudden, Time in a Bottle fucking started. And I was like, uh-oh. Okay, so it was on purpose. Okay, never mind.
So they have the father of the bride dance because he is now not only her father-in-law, but also her father by blood stamped on her forehead. Now, I know it wasn't perfect, but almost. What he did, the blood on her head, on her forehead, almost looked like an Ouroboros. It was not perfect. It did not go all the way around, but it did remind me of it. That's a little bit late. But anyway, Philippe.
Yeah, hour ago. Come on.
Has made it. Oh, stop it. Philippe has made it so that, and I think this comes out during their dance. We find out that Philippe has made it so that when Isipo returns, she won't learn of their presence. This is where he says, like, basically everyone will shut up. No one will spill the beans. And the chorus is, so Time in a Bottle by this time, as Summer said, has started and they're dancing and they have the, you know, the dialogue in front of it or over it. And the chorus is so beautiful because I had to actually go back in my mind and say, okay, well, what is the normal chorus? So if I could say Time in a Bottle, so it's minor, right? What is the, so the chorus is major, right? It never seems to be enough time to do the things. So what Rob said was that first verse never interested him. So he took the second one, which I apparently didn't remember because it was, and he did make some change to it, but he used the second verse. But anyway, you have to listen to the interview because it is so, not funny, but so interesting how it came around, because it's fantastic how it comes about. It was a perfect song choice. So it was a perfect song choice. And then they go to getting, so that song takes us from the happiness of the wedding or the after party. They're dancing and having chat and then probably eating somewhere. And then it also takes us into the consummation and they get undressed and then they finally do it. And it's like, and I'm not complaining that it was so short. It was short, but it was very,
I'm glad it was, because I hate it when they're overly long for no reason and they're gratuitous.
Yeah, it definitely was not gratuitous. You could tell they were nakies, but it was just enough for us to know that they did it. So later, I was like, Penny, for your thought, Matthew is holding a little carved toy horse. He confirms that, yeah, it was, he was thinking of his son, Lucas. And we are being prepped for what's to come. Hint-ish. She says that she sees glimpses of him as a father with Jack. She wishes she could give him a family. And then she reminds us, and this always hits me because I know Deb's decision. I know Diana's decision, but it's still hard to hear as a reader or a viewer. She reminds us by telling Matthew, in 60 to 70 years, I'll be gone. I'll be dead. And so this is the way, even though it's not the point of the conversation, this is the way that we're being told Diana will not become a vampire. Not that because it hasn't been a conversation, obviously, but a lot of fans, you know, at least I've read, are disheartened that Diana's going to die. I mean, we're all going to die at some point, but given the fact that she's with a vampire and she has the opportunity to live as long. So that's what she's saying. It's like, I'm going to die in 60 to 70 years and you'll be alone without me. And that's not just because I think you are and you would make a great father and I've seen you with Jack, but also I would like for you not to be alone when I'm gone. That's the whole conversation. And that's kind of where it ends. So as they're getting ready to go.
If I recall though, in the books, I believe he says to her, like, this is the last one for me. He doesn't intend to stick around.
Oh, he doesn't want to be around by himself.
When she's gone. He doesn't want...
I don't intend to stick around if you're not gonna be here once you're dead. I'm here every weekend. Philippe gives her some money and says, the women in this family manage their own finances, thank you. Which is why I'm giving you money, because I'm helping you do that. So it was kind of funny,
right? I was like, but it was weird.
I don't know why it makes me laugh. It just does.
Oh, you're gonna give me money and then my stepbrother, but also my husband, is also gonna have money. So it's all in the family. No big deal.
So he says the ring was Isabeau's message to him, a seal of her approval of Diana. And then he gives Diana his necklace.
It was just a little tiny bauble.
And he says, quote, and I will be with you always, as you will always be in my heart.
I thought this was a missed opportunity. In the books, before they leave, because this is the last time we see Philippe, they have a conversation where she says, you don't have to be afraid, because even in the darkness, I'll be there. And they don't even do that.
I agree with you. I was looking into all their lines to say, is there something there that I'm missing? And like, nope. It was almost like him telling her, I'll always be with you, was actually should have been the other way around, right? But it didn't happen. I don't think we missed it. If we miss it, please. We are happy to be corrected. Please let us know. But we were kind of listening for it. And I also didn't hear anything.
No, I didn't miss it. I watched it like 3 times. It was not done. It was never mentioned.
He says he will accompany them to the edge of the estate as they make their way to Bohemia. Philippe tells Matthew, you've found a woman worthy of you. Courage and hope to spare. And he tells him, quote, you are equally worthy of her. So stop regretting your life. Start living it. And there is one more matter to be put to rest. Whatever happens between the two of us in the future, I forgive you. Now go, my son. And he says, thank you, father. And the theme comes up as they ride off. And the rest of the show goes back and forth between Philippe sits down to write a letter. Our people on the way to Bohemia are still writing. And then we get Isabeau in her time.
She picks up that bound book again and doesn't open it.
Later, Philippe sits down to write. Well, first, Philippe sits down to write to Isabeau. And she is still looking. He has struggled to accept his mortality. This is what he's writing. But today, I have finally found the inspiration. For I am at peace. I am no longer afraid of my fate. Fate retains the power to surprise us. And then she finds the letter. It just pops up as she sees it. It picks up a book and she sees it poking out. And he continues to narrate. Our son is happy at last, mated to a woman who walks in the footsteps of the goddess. They journey now to Bohemia in search of the Book of Life. I fear there are difficult times ahead and that I trust they will return to you and that together you will forge a bold new future for our family. This is my final message to you, my love. I know now that there shall come a day when we will be parted, but until then, as in the afterlife, I will hold you in my heart. And how does the episode end? We get 3 different things. It ends on Isabeau's smiling, tear-filled face, on Philippe in silhouette against the sunset as he's standing, I believe, in a window, and Matthew and Diana are literally riding off into the sunset.
And then we get, stay tuned next time for Rudy!
Thank you, everyone, for listening. This was a difficult one. There's more difficult to come through, but I mean, there are more difficult episodes, but I don't... For me, this was the one... I cried more than just this one, but I never cried as much as with this one, so anywho's. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.